Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the danger in taking economic reports at face value. We learned this morning wholesale inflation is running at 40% on an annual basis, 40%. Yes, that is a pretty big number. It is also not the whole picture. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 13th of December. I'm glad to have you with us. The wholesale inflation number is a much easier to digest 3.4% when you break it down by month. Still, it is the biggest jump since the U.S. was trying to pay off the war in Vietnam. That would be August 1973 for the economic historians among you. As they always do, the guys with the green eye shades gave us another number today, too, something they call the core rate of inflation. It strips out the always volatile food and energy costs from that equation, and it gives us a much less scary number, inflation at 0.4%. But since we all do eventually wind up buying food and gas, does that number mean anything? We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to check it out.
To find out about the core rate, I went to economist James Galbraith at the University of Texas. He says it's a rate-setting signal for the Federal Reserve. He acknowledges that Americans do pay to drive and eat.
But that doesn't mean that one wants monetary policy decision-makers to react each time the price of oil or the price of food moves up or down.
Galbraith says without energy and food, the major element left in the core inflation rate is the change in wages. So this is how the Fed can see when gas and groceries are pushing up wages and other less volatile items, right?
The problem there, of course, is that by the time that's happened, it's a bit late for monetary policy to react to it. But if the core rate isn't all that useful, and the non-core rate isn't useful, it's not clear what in the inflation measurement is, in fact, a useful guide for monetary policymakers, exactly where they should be focusing their attention. It becomes a little vague.
Ah, now it's all perfectly clear. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
John is satisfied, but there is no joy in Mudville today because baseball is full of cheaters. Former Senator George Mitchell's report on illegal drug use in the major leagues was released today. Every team in the league had either a player or former player on the list, the report said. Kurt Bodenhausen's an editor at Forbes magazine. Good to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
We wanted to ask you about the distribution system for some of these steroids. Senator Mitchell mentioned clubhouse attendants and personal athletic trainers. There was also mention of some online pharmacies and what he called rejuvenation centers. How did that work?
Well, the rejuvenation centers have been pushing HGH, human growth hormone, for a long time as a anti-aging process. And so, you know, before the anti-aging thing got big, smart trainers and hangers-on for these players were, and doctors for that matter, were pushing players towards anti-aging clinics. And, you know, that was a prime source for human growth hormone for these guys.
And all they really needed was an address and a credit card number and a doctor's signature on a prescription script, and boom, it shows up at the doorstep, basically.
That's all it takes. You know, and Major League Baseball does not test for HGH. They still don't test for it because they can't test it through urine. They can only test it through blood. And so HGH is still a problem in Major League Baseball, without a doubt.
It seems like a reasonably foolproof business model for these online pharmacies. All you have to do is get the credit card number and you ship out the drugs.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, online pharmacies have sprouted up over the last few years and are a very lucrative business as long as you can find the doctors willing to sign prescriptions. And there are plenty of them out there willing to do it.
Let me ask you about labor relations here for a second. Senator Mitchell mentioned the players' union several times today. Will anything change with regard to steroids in baseball or drugs in baseball if there isn't some kind of movement in labor management relations?
Well, I things have changed. I mean, everything in not everything, but most of the stuff in the Mitchell report is detailing what went on, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. You know, Major League Baseball has just gotten their act together to some degree in terms of testing. The problem is there is no HGH test right now that can be done through urine. It's not just a Major League Baseball problem, but, you know, Major League Baseball for some reason gets an undue amount of scrutiny for their drug policy.
Are you a fan of the game?
Yeah, I'm a big baseball fan.
Is this going to keep you out of the seats next season?
Not at all. I don't think it'll keep anybody out of the seats next season. I mean, baseball is more popular than ever. You know, we've seen revenues, you know, up fivefold over the last 15 years. Set an attendance record last year. I bet you they'll break that record this year, probably draw 80 million people. You know, some of the, you know, poor performing franchises like Detroit, Milwaukee, even Kansas City, you know, things are really looking up in those cities, and they're continuing to increase attendance. And I see that happening in 2008 as well.
Kurt Bodenhausen at Forbes magazine. He's an editor there. Kurt, thanks a lot for your time.
All right. My pleasure.
George Mitchell's former colleagues down in the Senate seem to be losing their grip on the federal purse strings. The fiscal year started more than 2 months ago, but Congress still hasn't passed 11 of the 12 bills that fund the federal government. And those aren't the only pieces of economic legislation going nowhere, as our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barchet reports.
Democrats are not having much luck passing bills to do with the budget, taxes, energy, agriculture, health insurance, or housing. Bob Greenstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says Democrats have a 51-vote majority in the Senate, but that's not enough.
Most economic and legislation is stalled on the Hill. It moves through the House. It either then stalls in the Senate, being unable to secure 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, or the president vetoes it.
The business community is helping to erect those 60-vote barriers. Jay Timmons is the policy director at the National Association of Manufacturers. His group opposed an energy bill because it didn't want to lose tax breaks.
The fact that some things aren't getting done is actually a good thing from a perspective of the economy and jobs.
Timmons says Congress is getting some things done. It passed the Peru Free Trade Agreement. He hopes Congress will still pass legislation to make sure more than 20 million Americans aren't hit with the alternative minimum tax next year.
It's really not unusual at all for legislation to be piled up, if you will, at the end. Congress will work right until the 11th hour to get everything done and wrapped up.
Timmons and Greenstein both say the current logjam isn't a problem for the economy yet. But Greenstein says if the economy continues to deteriorate, the gridlock in Congress might prevent lawmakers from acting quickly and effectively. The government would have to spend money fast and early to offset a recession. I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
There was another economic report out today besides that inflation number. Retail sales were up last month, quite a bit too, and that eventually brought some joy to parts of Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Labor Department's had a busy day. Statisticians shared the November wholesale inflation number with us this morning. Also, the policy folks weighed in on your retirement plans, 401ks specifically. About 50 million of us contribute to them, but returns can vary widely, in part because of the fees we pay to plan administrators. Today, the Labor Department proposed some new rules, as Jeremy Hobson tells us.
The fees pay for selecting investments and managing the 401k fund, and they can add up. Stephen Butler, who runs a retirement plan consulting firm, says Americans are losing billions to overblown fees.
It's the magic of compound interest working against us when we start taking even a very small percentage out of money that could otherwise have been compounding on a tax-deferred basis.
Butler says the Labor Department's proposal is long overdue. It requires fund administrators to disclose their fees and conflicts of interest. But some say the new regulations aren't good enough.
Workers need to know what they're paying, and with this proposed regulation, we don't have that.
That's Rebecca Davis with the Pension Rights Center. She says the proposal only gives employers more information about the fees, not workers. But Assistant Secretary of Labor Bradford Campbell says, why smother employees in too many details about their 401k?
If I get a 400-page prospectus that describes all of the various information about it, I'm not as likely to read that as I would be if I got a concise disclosure that lets me choose between the options by telling me the basic facts I need.
Some industry groups say too much information could scare employees away from investing in a very important retirement fund. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
From retirement to taxes we go. Congress and the White House are still trying to come to terms on a deal to fix the alternative minimum tax, as Jill Barshay alluded to a moment ago. The House wants to find a way to replace the revenue that would be lost with an AMT patch. The Senate says fine, but you got to do it with no new taxes. Caught in the middle is the humble taxpayer. More than 25 million of us could wind up owing an average of $2,000 extra dollars come April the 15th. Also squeezed is a group it's often hard to feel sorry for, the Internal Revenue Service. Tess Vigeland covers personal finance for us. Hey, Tess.
Hi, Kai.
So the politicians are having their way sort of with the tax code here. How long before it becomes an actual problem?
Kai, it already is, actually, at least for the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS Oversight Board actually raised a red flag about all kinds of problems that are going to be caused because of the delays in resolving this issue. There's the most practical of them all, which is that it takes time to program the computers that go over our tax returns. If the tax law changes, they say that reprogramming can take upwards of 7 weeks. Now, right now, tax filing season is scheduled to start on January 14th, but that could be delayed until at least late January, possibly later. What that means is, if you're planning on a refund to, say, pay for your holiday shopping activities, potentially it's going to be several weeks late in getting to you.
Yeah. I'm no tax expert here, but it seems to me that there's a pretty easy solution, right? You have one set of things ready to go for the tax law that is, and another set of rules ready to go for the tax law that might be, and then you just flip a switch and boom.
You're thinking anything's easy for the IRS?
Yeah, right.
They say that their systems actually need to be based on whatever the current law is.
Oh, well, that makes sense,
instead of speculative law. And, you know, another question that's come up is, you know, well, can't you tell if a return is supposed to be subject
right,
to AMT
right,
or not? Well, the answer is no. The system cannot tell the difference between those kinds of returns. And frankly, that's not really a surprise because how can the computer tell when we as taxpayers often can't tell until after we've completed our returns and, oh, surprise, you know, you're subject to the AMT.
Yeah. Worst case here, what happens if there is no fix?
Well, we could potentially go back to paper filing, but again, that causes a problem because so many of us have actually switched to electronic filing already that the IRS has closed down some of its processing sites. Right now, it only has 5. So the Oversight Board is saying that as electronic filings would drop, that would create weeks-long backlogs. And, you know, if there is no AMT fix, well, then the IRS is basically ready to go. But that also means that some 25 million taxpayers are going to fall into the AMT. That's up from just 4 million last year. I shouldn't say just, but 4 million last year. And that is a whole lot of angry taxpayers in an election year.
And so we're back to where we started, which is politics and the tax code.
Yep. And, you know, there really is no indication at this point of when they might pass a fix.
Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program. It's called Marketplace Money. Thank you, Tess.
Always a pleasure to talk about taxes, Guy.
There were protests this week in New Orleans. The city is planning to demolish 4 huge public housing developments. They're being torn down to make way for new and more expensive buildings. Activists say the new New Orleans may not be making enough room for the poor. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
To get a sense of just how extreme the situation is, consider how much New Orleans resident Gloria Stevenson pays for rent now compared to before Hurricane Katrina.
I was paying $295 rent. When I returned back home, it went from $295 to $1,600.
She used to live in public housing. Right now, in New Orleans, that's not an option. Most of the public housing has been shuttered, but not yet replaced. On top of that, the storm took thousands of apartments off the market. That leaves renters paying double, triple, even quadruple for housing. Bill Quigley is a Loyola University law professor who represents former public housing tenants.
We, in our area, are facing what most experts call the worst affordable housing crisis since the Civil War.
The housing crisis brought activists to City Hall earlier this week, trying to block the demolition of four public housing complexes. Before Katrina, they were home to more than 20,000 people. Bill Quigley says many of those residents will never be able to return because the new mixed-income developments that replace public housing won't have enough apartments for the poor.
They reduce the number of these heavily subsidized units by 82%. At the end, even if you count all, even the market rate ones, the city ends up with a loss of 2,700 apartments after HUD has spent $750 million.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development disputes those numbers.
The total number of housing that we're bringing back is the same number of housing that was occupied prior to Katrina.
That's Donna White, spokeswoman for HUD. She says after the old public housing complexes are torn down, most of the former tenants will get new low-income units, and those who don't will have their rent subsidized by HUD.
It's a much more cost-effective way for HUD to demolish the old housing and give these families better housing in newer, safe neighborhoods.
But what if the newer, safer housing is in a different neighborhood, far from friends, family, and the local church? Gloria Stevenson has been coming to St. Jude's for 35 years. It provides spiritual support. And now that she's paying so much for rent, Stevenson also relies on the church for canned goods and charity.
Half the time, I don't know whether we're going to make it for one day or another.
Everyone agrees that the situation for renters in New Orleans is bleak, and it's going to get worse now that FEMA has begun to evict thousands of Katrina victims who have been living in emergency trailers. The homeless population is already double what it was before Katrina. Gloria Stevenson says she'd like to get one of the new apartments in the future mixed-income communities, but...
The thing of it is, I'm not promised to get one. They constantly say that they want us to come back home, but out of all reality, they don't want us to come back home, because if they did, they wouldn't make life so hard for us here.
Activists have pledged to fight the demolition of the old public housing buildings right up to the end. Stevenson's former home could come down as early as this Saturday. In New Orleans, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, what you gain and what you give as a charity online.
We have been very oriented toward closing off our networks, grabbing supporters, and then keeping them, holding a tight rein on them.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 44 points today, a third of 1%, to close at 13,517. The NASDAQ dropped 2 points. That's about a tenth percent, closed at 2668. The S&P 500 edged up 1 point, a tenth percent there as well, ended the day at 1488. Countrywide plunged 4.25% today. Bear Stearns stumbled 2.4%. Citigroup down about 1.5%. Washington Mutual slid nearly 3% after Bank of America cut the ratings on the country's biggest savings and loan from neutral to sell. Home Depot and Target Corporation led the charge of chain stores lower after wholesale prices jumped in November. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 4.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. And by the Medtronic Foundation, supporting the health of people and communities through grant-making, employee giving, and volunteerism. Online at Medtronic.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on the Consumer Price Index for November. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. And on December 14, 1911, Norwegian Roald Amundsen was the first explorer to reach the South Pole after a long, chilly journey. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
If karma worked perfectly, every dollar you gave would go directly to the people you wanted to help. But we all know that's rarely the case. Today in Washington, a congressional committee spent some time on military charities. The American Institute of Philanthropy says those organizations could be better at what they do. 12 of the 29 charities it reviewed got a failing grade. As our series on philanthropy continues, commentator Hunter Lewis says there's more the U.S. can do to make giving more affordable.
If we were really serious about ending poverty in America, what would we do? Rely solely on economic growth, on government programs, on a mix of private and public, the so-called third way? Let's consider a fourth way. We hear a lot about social entrepreneurship. This means running a nonprofit more like a business. Social entrepreneurs are making a big difference, but they still lack capital. Nonprofits today represent only a small sliver of the economy. We could change this by making charitable giving more affordable. At present, when you donate to charity, you take a tax deduction. If you are in the 25% tax bracket, government will reimburse 25% of the value of the gift. Most of it still comes out of your pocket. Let's have charitable tax credits as well. With tax credits, you could take a charitable gift off your taxes, dollar for dollar. You would have a simple choice: pay it to government or give it to charity. This could produce a torrent of cash for charities. At first, this might apply only to charities working directly on the ground to help the poor. In the long run, government might outsource all its social programs to a much larger nonprofit sector. The charitable tax credit approach could help new business entrepreneurs too. They could donate shares to charity in lieu of taxes. This would leave more cash to grow their business faster and create more jobs. Charitable tax credits would also make sense for estate taxes. Estates represent a lifetime of saving, and we need savings in America today. By using tax credits, we could steer more estates into charitable endowments. That would protect the savings. The American political argument is usually framed in terms of having more or less government. Let's try something new. Let's expand the nonprofit sector and bring more hope and help to those who need it.
Hunter Lewis is the author of Are the Rich Necessary? He's also the co-founder of the global investment firm Cambridge Associates. So the government could alter the tax code to give giving a bump, as Mr. Lewis was talking about. But one of the biggest changes to philanthropy has already arrived, courtesy of that little innovation that's already changed so much about the way we spend money. Nonprofits are increasingly using the web, things like online auctions and social networks. And in the process, they're learning that sometimes you have to give a little to get a lot more. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
It's hard not to cry at the Animal Protection Society of Durham. Don't get me wrong, the animals get excellent care. But you just know that most of them could bark you a hard luck story. Shelter director Jennifer Braylor introduced me to a young stray named Solomon.
Solomon, who is very high energy, is a puppy, probably about 5 months of age.
When I first met Solomon, scruffy, Benji-esque, yappy, it didn't look good. But the puppy wrote a Hollywood ending to his story with the help of the internet. Solomon went home with Buddy Priest, who found out about him online.
I wanted a dog to be a friend for my dog, and website's just a logical place to go because it's got the pictures and some stats.
The Animal Protection Society invested $1,500 into its web presence 2 years ago. It added more info about the animals and sent out more donor emails. Development Director Sarah Crawford says since then, the nonprofit's doubled its budget.
We went from raising about $200,000 to raising $400,000 annually, and online donations increased by about 25%.
According to the E-Philanthropy Foundation, total online giving in the U.S. last year hit about $6.8 billion. That's an increase of more than 50% from 2005. But having a website and accepting online donations, that's just the beginning. Consultant Ruby Sinreich works for the peace group Fellowship of Reconciliation. She says to be effective online, charities need to be where their supporters hang out, whether that's the online world Second Life or social networking sites.
Increasingly, people are going on the internet to talk about the issues that they care about and the organizations that they care about, and they're going to be doing that whether your organization is there with them or not.
Facebook has an application that lets members recruit and donate for causes, then tell their friends about it. JustGive.org is like a dating service that connects people with charities. At Change.org, supporters have connected to more than 1,000 nonprofits. But while network-centric philanthropy may be the future, it's not quite the present. Just 3% of all U.S. donations are made online. Change.org founder Ben Rattray says nonprofits have yet to embrace the internet to make personal connections with supporters.
Websites replaced brochures and email replaced direct mail, but the means of communication has remained largely impersonal in one way.
Being everywhere online has a price of its own, message control. Once you put the word out on Facebook, it can take on a life of its own. Again, Ruby Sinreich, the consultant who's working with the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
We have been very oriented toward closing off our networks, grabbing supporters and then keeping them, holding a tight rein on them. We do have to give up a little bit of control, and that's hard for us.
But ultimately, Sinreich says nonprofits have to trust the people who support them. A canned, one-way message, she says, is ineffective compared to all those friends talking you up on Facebook. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You can find more of our philanthropy series on our website, what a tax code change might mean, as well as other stories at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes before you go today. You know all those mortgage-backed securities we've been telling you about? They've been bouncing around Wall Street since summertime, causing all kinds of trouble for the banks that hold them. But they are selling for cheap right now. And Blackstone, the private equity group, announced today it's created a fund to buy up some of that distressed debt. It's got $1.3 billion to play with in that market. And in some other investment news, JetBlue sold a 19% piece of itself today. The German carrier Lufthansa forked over $305 million to get into the U.S. discount carrier business. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 44 points. That's a third of 1%. The Nasdaq sloughed off 2 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 rose almost 2 points. That's a tenth percent there. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, talking money with family can be tough, even when you're giving it away.
You end up with sometimes a clash that may look like sort of a bad family vacation.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.